Okay, so what I want to do with you guys tonight is cover two things. I want to go through the story to understand the Purim story, and I'd like to talk about a couple of really pertinent and relevant messages from the Purim story. One I think is very relevant that everybody's talking about today, which is anti-Semitism, because it'll come up very soon. But let's just jump right in. And it's one of the probably most misunderstood holidays. It's a lot of fun. People love Purim. What's not to love? It's costumes and drinking and dressing up. But I want to get a little deeper. Why do we dress up on Purim? Why do we drink? Why are we still talking about this old form of anti-Semitism from Persia? What does it have to do with our lives today? So anybody, first, let's begin just with a history. Who can tell me when this story is taking place?
Hello.
Welcome. How are you? When is the story taking place?
I got it.
I don't need a year. I just like...
He's looking at his timeline.
Yeah, we're in
Babylonian captivity.
So we're like 560. No, we're after the return of the Jews. We're like 538, aren't we? That's what he said.
Very good. So real briefly, just so everyone has a benchmark in Jewish history... The Jewish people are enslaved. Welcome, nice to see you. The Jewish people are enslaved. For how long? How long were the Jews enslaved in Egypt?
250 years.
How many? 210 years. Good, 210 years. The Jewish people get out. They come to Israel. They build for themselves eventually. Who builds the first temple? Welcome, guys. Shlomo HaMelech builds the first temple. How long does that temple stand?
Oh, it's like... 500 years? 300 years?
Anybody know how long the first temple?
420 years? Who destroys the first temple?
Babylonians.
The Babylonians in the year 586 BC. Nebuchadnezzar, that's going to be relevant. What happens? Don't say it yet. You're killing my whole class.
You're reading off a sheet.
No, I did a little
What happens to the Jews who survive the Babylonian destruction of the first temple? What happens to them?
Some of them go in exile.
Almost all of them are exiled to where? Where do they go?
Babylon.
Where's Babylon?
Iraq.
It's today Iraq. It's basically today Iraq. Okay? What happens to them there? Who is now... You understand, the world was like superpowers in those days. Egypt, Assyria, Babylon. Who destroys the Babylonian Empire? Who's the next empire that takes over the world? Anybody learn any...
Greeks.
Persian. Before the Greeks are the Persians. The Greeks are the Hanukkah story. The Persians are the Purim story. Okay? We're going to talk about the title also. Why is it called Purim, which just means lottery? We're going to get to that. We're going to do it all. It's going to be great. Now, the Jews are living where?
Babylon.
They're living in Babylon, which is now called... what's that? It's basically where Iraq is today. And the Jewish people are living there. The Megillah, we're jumping in. That's where we are right now. Follow with me on source number one. It came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus. Who was Ahasuerus? Who was he, though? He was the king of?
Iran.
Of what? Not Iran.
Persia.
Okay? This is before Iran. Iranians consider themselves Persians. They don't consider themselves Arabs. They do consider themselves connected to this kingdom. It's true. As it came to pass the days of Ahasuerus, who reigned from Hodu to Kush. You know what Hodu and Kush are? Hebrew words for?
Indian.
No, countries, what?
India,
very good. And India and Ethiopia. Is anybody... I learned geography from playing Kushai. Risk. So if you remember back to the Risk board, anybody know where
Kamchatka.
Ethiopia... Sorry. Kamchatka, I remember that. Do you have any idea how vast this territory was from India to Ethiopia? It says how many provinces were... This is really bothering me. 127. I'm not jumping. Nobody gets scared. 127 provinces.
Yes, is that bad?
127 provinces in ancient Persia, from Mehodu v'ad Kush. And what happens? Ahasuerus, in the third year, look, it's underlined, made a feast for all of his officials, his servants, for the army. They're like the brass, the important people. And he, what is he doing at this party? The party, by the way, was supposed to last for 180 days, verse 4. He displays the riches of his glorious kingdom, the honor of his splendid majesty. Remember, everything in the Torah. Oh, I forgot to ask you. Where is this? What are we reading from? This is called the book of
Esther.
Esther. Where is the book of Esther found?
Tanakh.
Is it in the written Torah or the oral Torah?
Neither.
No, it's in the written Torah. It's in the written Torah. Which part? There are three parts to the written Torah. You're out of hand tonight. What are the three parts of the written Torah? There's an acronym. What do we call it in Hebrew? Tanakh. Everyone should know that. Tanakh. Torah, referring to the five books of Moses. Nevi'im, prophets, like Isaiah, Ezekiel, Joshua, Samuel, Kings. And then there's Ketuvim, writings. What's an example of a writing? The book of Proverbs. The book of Psalms is in the writings. Very good. And the book of Esther. Okay? They're all part of the written, canonized, 24 books, canonized books of Hebrew Scripture called Tanakh. Okay? That's the source that we're studying from here. Okay? So now, in verse 4...
What is the other country? How is that pronounced? Because it's probably not Media. So how is it actually pronounced? On the...
Madai.
Okay.
Madai. Paras Umadai.
What's that?
Paras. Media is just one of the it was referred to like Shushan is the capital of ancient Persia, of this empire. And Media was also a very important like country or republic, if you will, within ancient Persia. It was a kind of vast empire. Just think former Soviet Union. Soviet Union was comprised of all these different parts in the Ukraine and this part over here in the east and the west is massive. The United States, all these different states. It's one big hoo-ha. That's the same thing. Except there's no other superpower in the world. It's just the Persians. And the Jews fall under their reign as they're kicked out of Israel. And now they're at this party. I'm going to get to this now. This is very important. The party lasts for 180 days. And look at verse 5. When these days were fulfilled, the king now makes a second party. And this party lasts only for 7 days. And this party is open to anyone who's in Shushan. Now, I'm going to throw in something from rabbinic literature. When I say rabbinic literature, I'm referring now to the oral tradition. Okay? The oral tradition, there's an entire tractate of the Talmud devoted to commentary on the Megillah. That's called Megillah. Okay? And in the Megillah, it talks about an edict by Mordechai that the Jewish people should not go to this party. Now, what's wrong with going to the party? If you were invited to the White House, would you not, you know, let's say the president invited you to the Hanukkah party, the White House Hanukkah party, would you not attend? What's wrong with going to the party at the palace? Everybody was invited. It's a very nice gesture on the part of the king.
So they wanted the Jews to assimilate?
So one of the things that this party... So there is a prophecy. This is very important. There was a prophecy recorded in the Tanakh, in the book of Daniel, that said that 70 years after the destruction of the first temple, the Jewish people would return to Israel and rebuild their temple. Did that prophecy come true?
Say again?
There was a prophecy that 70 years after the destruction of the first temple, of Solomon's temple in 586 BC by the Babylonians, the Jewish people would come back to Israel and rebuild their temple. So it actually happened, except there was a little of a timing question, and I don't know if this is what you were alluding to, but the rabbis teach that one of the reasons, not the superficial reason, you'll see in a minute the superficial reason Achashverosh throws this party, but a secondary reason was to celebrate what Achashverosh believed was the end of Jewish history. Because according to his accounting, the 70 years had come and gone, and the Jews had never returned. And how do we know that one of the things they were celebrating was the end of Jewish history? Because what does Achashverosh display at this party? Look at the next verse. Look at verse 6. There were hangings of white... What's that? This is right before the... 70.
What, 70?
We believe it was 70 years, correct. 70 years, and this is at the tail end of that 70-year period, but not quite there. In fact, to fast forward to the end of this, Does anybody know who actually let the Jews back to Israel when the story is over? It was Darius. Darius, according to some, I don't have evidence of this, but some historians believe that Darius was the son of Queen Esther and Ahasuerus, who was the one who ultimately let the Jewish people go back to Israel and build that temple 70 years after the first one was destroyed, just like the prophecy says. But Ahasuerus misunderstood. He thought that the temple had to be built by the 70th year, the second one. And it wasn't built by then, so he figured it's all over. And look at verse 6. There were hangings of white fine cotton, turquoise wool, held with cords of fine linen and purple wool, upon silver rods and marble pillars. Why does the Torah have to tell us all this? So every single question I give you tonight will have two answers. We'll have a superficial, physical answer for the physical world in which we live. And it will also have a spiritual, beneath the surface answer. What was the physical reason that he was showing his opulence and his affluence and his prominence? If you know a little about Ahasuerus, you'll be able to figure this out. What's that? All this stuff was from the temple. In fact, when it says in verse 7, the drinks were served in golden vessels, vessels of diverse form, if anyone's familiar with the trup, you know what the trup is? It's the tune that we sing any part of the Torah. The trup goes back thousands of years. The tune is a very upbeat for Purim, except when you get to this verse. When you get to this verse, you have to read it like this. And tell me if you recognize this tune. V'kelim, me'kelim shonim, and there were vessels of the old vessels. Anybody know a tune that sounds so sad? What part of Tanakh do we also read with that tune? On Tisha B'Av, very good. We read the Eicha. We flip to an Eicha tune when we get to that verse. Why? Because what's Eicha about?
It's like how
How could the temple have been destroyed? How could our people be exiled? What's going on at this party? Why does Mordechai care that the Jews are attending a party that's open to anyone, to all the citizens of Shushan? Because this party is celebrating the non-fulfillment of the 70-year prophecy that the Jewish people would go back to Israel, rebuild their temple, and be this great people again for the world. No, what Ahasuerus wanted and what was beginning to happen was that the Jews were assimilating into Persian society. So much so that they would attend the party where the king is coming out in the priestly garb, drinking from vessels that were taken from the temple. Now why would Ahasuerus want to do this on a simple level? To show he's the man. To show he's in charge. Who makes parties like this where they're showing everything off? What kind of person does that usually? When you have to demonstrate to everyone how rich and powerful and influential you are.
Very insecure person.
Someone with insecure. Who is Ahasuerus? And by the way, this is very important for the storyline. Why is it important for us to know that Ahasuerus is insecure? And what else happens at that party, which I don't have in the text here, but who can tell me what happens at that party? Ahasuerus calls for someone to come out and show off her beauty.
Vashti.
What does Vashti do?
She says no.
She disses the king. And I don't have the verses for you, but you can look at it. It's really interesting. In the middle of this party, Ahasuerus calls together his cabinet, his closest advisors. The Megillah actually lists the names of all of the closest advisors, and he takes counsel with them. What do I do? I ask the queen to come out. And by the way, the commentaries say that he asked the queen to come out. The verse doesn't say this explicitly, it just says to come out in her crown. And Rashi asks, what else does a queen wear? And Rashi answers, what he really meant was only the crown. He wanted her to show everyone how gorgeous and beautiful. And by her saying no, why does he have to take counsel with his advisors? Becomes like a national security crisis. He has to call a cabinet meeting. What's going on? Because who is Vashti? And who is Ahasuerus? And you need this information to understand when Esther comes into the picture. How she manipulates the situation brilliantly. Who was Ahasuerus and who was Vashti? Vashti, you said before, was? Now you can speak, young man.
Nebuchadnezzar's granddaughter.
Did you say abracadabra? What did you say?
Nebuchadnezzar.
All right. Nebuchadnezzar. Let's say that together.
Nebuchadnezzar's
granddaughter. He was the king of Babylon. Ahasuerus was a stable boy. He married into royalty. He was always insecure. And he has to show everyone, I'm the guy in charge. And guess what happens? When he calls his wife in, who he got the job through, and she says, no, I'm not coming out. That becomes a state issue. That becomes a big problem for Achashverosh, because he's trying to demonstrate he's the man, he's independent, he's the sovereign. And she's like, no, you're the king because of me. You married into this, and you're really not that powerful. And so what does he do? He kills her. Now, of course, we think as Jews reading the story, yeah, that's just to pave the way for Queen Esther. But that's also to tell us something very important, that he was insecure and that he needed to be seen in a certain way. And we're going to need that, and Esther certainly is going to need that for a little later. This is a fascinating story, and by the way, you could read this whole story without actually, it's the least biblical sounding story in Tanakh, in my opinion. In fact, God's name is mentioned nowhere in Megillat Esther. Hashem's name is mentioned nowhere. Because one of the challenges, and this is the challenge that the Jews of our ancestors faced, and we face this today, is that sometimes God is not so obvious. And you can write God out of this whole story. You can kind of explain this whole thing, like, yeah, there was the Jews that got exiled, and there was this, and he killed the queen, and now what happens? And the idea is to find God when he is hidden. What does the word Esther mean? Esther, Aster, Panecha, God says, I will hide my face. That's why we wear costumes. That's why we dress up on Purim. It's a deep idea.
Where is that from?
The verse I just quoted is from the five books of when God says that something bad will happen, God is going to hide his face from the rest of the Jewish people. It's the way we understand God during the Holocaust.
Who is he speaking to when he said
that? The Jewish people.
And there was not like a specific instance when he said that?
That verse that I just quoted was taken from the Tochacha, when God rebukes and chastises Jewish people and says, what will happen if we don't follow in his ways? He says, I'm going to hide my face. And God sometimes is hidden. And Esther was also told, let's get into Esther now. Who was Esther? Who was she?
Convert.
Not necessarily. A convert. She was Mordechai's, some most people believe she was his niece.
The Midrash also says his wife.
Correct. There are different opinions as to who she was, but she was a nice Jewish religious girl. And she was taken, what were you going to say?
Back then, also people were able to marry the niece.
Yes. So wasn't able, a lot of people did. Right.
Encouraged.
Right. It was an encouraged thing, actually. Yeah. It was part of the culture. But what's important is that she was told by, what happened? How did she get to become the new queen? Is that a job for a nice Jewish girl? She was the most beautiful. The text says, Vati lakach Esther. Esther was actually taken. And the rabbis understand that she was taken against her will. That this was not something she wanted. You didn't really have much of a choice. I'm sure some people might have wanted to be part of the king's harem. This is not some love affair, by the way. She was just part of hundreds of other women. But she'd be deemed the most beautiful and therefore the queen. And Mordechai, her uncle, her husband, whatever, tells her, don't reveal that you are Jewish. Again, hidden. She has to remain, her identity has to remain hidden. Again, with the costumes, her name, Esther, means to be hidden. And of course, it works out nicely, because when this anti-Semite called Haman, you always hear the banging whenever you hear his name, when you know, she's sort of in the right place at the right time. But I'm going to get to that soon. Who is Haman? Who is he in the court? He's the most, yeah, he's more than an advisor, actually. What's that? He's like the prime minister. What else do we know about Haman? What else do we know about him?
Two or three pointed at.
Anybody else? What other information do we know about Haman? They what?
We named a delicious form of snack.
A Hamantaschen? Oh, the Hamantaschen, that's right. They say he had like a three-cornered hat, and that's how we got the Hamantaschen. That's what most people know about the story. Okay, keep going. It's a gastronomical Judaism. What's that? Okay, good. The Torah mentions in Megillat Esther that he's a direct descendant of Agag, who was the king of Amalek. Who was Amalek? Amalek was the
Esau's grandson.
They were the first to attack the Jewish people when they left Egypt. And they did it in a very despicable manner. They attacked the women and children from behind. And it was an unprovoked attack, and it was an affront to God himself, because you didn't touch the Jew when you left Egypt, because the world knew what happened. 10 plagues, splitting of the Red Sea. Like, what they did was to allow for others to attack, because before them, nobody had the audacity. Medrash says that when the, you know, you go into the bathtub for the first time, it's very hot. So the first time you go into the bathtub, you cool it down a little. That's what a Malek does. A Malek cooled it down and made it okay for other people to hate the Jew. They were the first. Haman, and by the way, this is so important, I'm going to get into, say something about anti-Semitism in a minute. Haman, it doesn't really explain why he hated the Jews. It only says one thing, why he developed such an enmity for the Jewish people. Anybody know? Mordechai, the chief Jew. By the way, Mordechai was considered the greatest rabbinic personality of the generation. He was a member of the Sanhedrin, the Jewish High Court. Mordechai would not bow. He would not prostrate himself before Haman, which he required everyone to do in his court, and somehow this infuriated him. So I don't know, like a normal person who has anger issues might have gotten upset with him, but somehow that became extrapolated to all Jews. And now he wants to get the king. He's powerful, but not powerful enough to promulgate some edict to kill all Jews, millions of Jews throughout the 127 provinces. How does he convince King Ahasuerus? This is very important. How does he convince King Ahasuerus? Okay, this is very important because a lot of people think, oh, no. Money. Haman was extraordinarily wealthy. He offered the king tens of thousands of silver talents that he would deposit into the king's treasury. And who is Ahasuerus there for? Does he hate Jews? Does he love Jews? He's like an opportunist. If killing the Jews is good for him, if he can make a few bucks, great. If not, he'll let the Jews live. He goes with the wind. Haman is a true anti-Semite. But what does he say to Ahasuerus to, quote unquote, convince him that he can get away with it? Look at source number two. Haman said to King Ahasuerus, "There is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your realm. Their laws are different from other peoples, and they do not observe the king's laws. Therefore, it is not befitting the king to tolerate them." What kind of argument, and who else used that argument in Jewish history? What kind of argument is that in terms of, why would that help Ahasuerus, convince Ahasuerus to kill the Jews? What is he saying there?
It's taking away his power.
What's that?
It's taking away his power.
Taking away whose power?
The king's power.
How is it taking? Because they're not loyal citizens. Good. He's playing on his insecurity. Good. What else?
Tells him they're not united, so you don't have to worry about it.
You don't have to worry about any kind of resistance. And the rabbis say something else in the oral tradition. This is very important. Look at the Hebrew. You see where I underlined it in source number two? The first word that's underlined, the word yeshno, which means there is. Yeshno amecha. There is this one nation, mefuzar mefurad, scattered and dispersed, bein amin, amongst the provinces. But the word yeshno is linguistically connected to the word yashan. Yashan means to sleep. What was Haman telling Ahasuerus about the Jewish people? Because you could say, what do you mean, those Jews, they had all those plagues, they had the splitting of the Red Sea. I mean, maybe their God will come to their aid again. No, you don't have to worry about them. Not only are they dispersed and scattered, not only will they not join together, band together, and form a resistance, but they're also asleep. That's what the Talmud says. They're sleeping spiritually. They have no more zichuyot, the Talmud says. They have no more spiritual merits that their God will come and swoop in and save the day. They are easy prey. They are not united physically, and they are not connected spiritually. Go for it. Here's the money. He really did it because of the money. But even a guy who's going to get a lot of money doesn't want a fight, doesn't want a battle on his hands. And he also doesn't want some, maybe he's superstitious and thinks that their God will do something terrible to him like God did to Pharaoh. Now, you don't have to be concerned about that, says Haman. They're disunified, and they are disconnected. Esther finds out about the decree. Initially, what was her reaction when Mordechai goes to her? She doesn't even know. And by the way, before we get to that, what was the decree ultimately? The decree was that every man, woman, and child, every Jew would be annihilated, round up, and killed on what day?
14 Shabbat.
the 14th of the Hebrew month of Adar. How did they choose that date?
A lottery.
Purim. A lottery. Why is that significant? Why do we call this whole holiday Purim? A lottery. I'm going to come back to that. I want you to hold on to that question. Now, Mordechai finds out before Esther. He tells Esther what's going on. What is Esther's immediate reaction? It's not in here. Does anybody know? Esther's like, oh my God, so good, I'm the queen. I'll take care of this, no problem. What does she say? Do you remember? Yeah, what do you mean, what can I do? What do you mean? She's the queen. What could she do? She can burst into the king's palace, into the chamber of the king, and demand that he call off the dogs. He's the king. She's the queen.
She can't appear before him without being summoned.
So she says to Achashverosh, she says to Mordechai, "How can I? What do you mean? What do you want me to do? I'm just I'm in the harem. You can't go unsummoned to the king. And I haven't been summoned 30 days. I go unsummoned, that could be the end of me." Now what was she really saying? What's problematic with that? It's not what you would think a righteous woman like Queen Esther would say. First of all, what is she also thinking, just on the human level? The edict is that everyone's going to die if you're Jewish. So what is she implying?
She's not Jewish.
She's passing.
Well, she is Jewish, clearly, but she hasn't revealed that. So maybe she's thinking, I don't know, there's all sorts of things. The Torah doesn't say. It leaves it to our imagination that what?
Your life is more important. It's not worth potentially sacrificing it to stress.
And I can get away with it. Now, this is so interesting. The next line, I'm sorry I didn't put it on your sheet. The next line in the Megillah is the most dramatic moment in the whole story. Do you know what Mordechai says to Esther?
You do not.
He says, Revach v'hatzalah, which means salvation and expansiveness. Yamod layudim will appear for the Jews mimakom acher, from another place. What does Mordechai tell Esther? You don't do this, we're going to be fine. God is not going to let the Jewish people be destroyed. You know, Mordechai was a man of great faith, but perhaps this is why you became the queen. Such a powerful lesson. Sometimes, you know, and when I heard this, I'm like, Mordechai, what are you doing? You want to motivate Queen Esther, what do you tell her? We need you. Without you, we're dead. What does he say? We don't need you. God's going to save us anyway, but maybe this is why you became queen. No, Mordechai understood that God would never allow the Jewish people. We have a covenant dating back to Abraham. We might get kicked out of country. We might have our temple destroyed. There might be terrible persecutions, pogroms, even a Holocaust. But God's not going to let the Jewish people disappear. We'll survive this. But maybe this is why you were the queen. Very important lesson in life. That sometimes we think, well, what does it matter what I do? You know what it matters? It matters for you. Maybe this is why you're in that job. Maybe this is why you got set up with that person. You so angry with your friend who fixed you up on that date. What was he thinking? What was she thinking? What am I doing here? No, there's a reason. The Torah is teaching that there are no coincidences in life. What's the Hebrew word for the holiday? It's called a Purim. It's a lottery. It's happenstance. It's just by chance. There was an anti-Semite, now there's a queen, a Jewish queen, and the lottery and the this. No, everything happens. You are the queen for a reason. Everything in life happens for a purpose and a reason. The Ramchal, I'm teaching it, the next class afterwards I'm teaching, and the Ramchal says that every person's situation is deliberate. You are where you're supposed to be. That doesn't mean we don't make mistakes, we don't have free will. But if you're in a place, you're there for a reason. And a person might be very wealthy, he says, but they're being tested in a certain situation to see whether or not they can become generous, or if they become indifferent to the plight of the poor. A person might be poor, and that person might have to develop their personality to see whether or not they can somehow subsist on less. Everyone is in a situation that they need to be in to be able to actualize their unique potential. This is an incredibly important message that's coming out of the Megillah. Now, what does Queen Esther ultimately say? Yeah, question?
So, in the Megillah, when Mordechai says this, all right, that's my question. He seems to be referencing God, but he doesn't actually use the word God.
God's name is not mentioned anymore, because again, you could read off God from this whole story. You can just say it's all happenstance, it's all coincidence, it's all just regular human stuff.
But when he's making this speech to Esther, is he? He's not using the word God?
No.
How is he framing it to her?
Oh, what does he say? No, he just says, he doesn't say that Hashem, he says, Revach Vatzalah Yamud Mimakom Acher, salvation will come from another place. That's what he says. He doesn't say God will save us anyway. I'm saying that.
Okay. You said this is the only instance where God's name isn't mentioned?
The only book of Tanakh, of the 24 canonized book of Hebrew scripture, where God's name is never mentioned. By the way, is God's name? I told you that everything in this story has a superficial understanding and a deeper one. The superficial, oh, God's not there, or is he? The rabbis in the Talmud would say that every time the word HaMelech is used, the king, it's not simply referring to Ahasuerus. It's actually referring to the King of Kings, to God himself. And what happens in the next verse now? What does Esther say to Mordechai? What does Esther say to Mordechai? She says, fine, I'm with the game. I'm going to go try to save the Jews. What does she say? Look at source number 3. Anybody want to read source number 3? Anybody?
I'll read it.
Go for it. Thank you.
Okay. Then Esther said to reply to Mordechai, go assemble all the Jews that are to be found in Shushan and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day, and I, with my maids, will fast also. Thus I will come to the king, though it is unlawful, and if I perish, I perish.
Now, why is Esther asking the Jewish people to fast so that when she comes to the king, she'll have a better chance of getting the right reply?
Sacrifice.
Well, link it a little to what you saw in 2. What was, I'm going to give you a hint, because I have a very specific message. What exactly was...
Oh, the Jews are not alone. That they're sleeping.
They're sleeping spiritually, and they're what?
Not united.
And they're not united people-wise. What does Esther understand? That this is not happening for, oh, there's anti-Semitism. No, there's always something deeper. Haman, like any good anti-Semite, knows our points of weakness. Our points of weakness at that moment was we were disunified and we were disconnected spiritually. So what did she rest? What was the recipe there for? Get the Jewish people to do something together and make it spiritual and religious. Fast. So when I come before the king, who's the king, guys? King is Ahasuerus. But who's really the king? Because God's God. She wants to come before Hashem. She understood all of this. Everything that we see in the physical world is but a manifestation of something happening spiritually in the spiritual realms. So she understands that if she's going to save the Jews, it can't just be here. It's got to be there. And she understands that this is all happening to wake up her people because we are assimilating. What is the Purim story? What does it open up? What does the Megillat Esther open with? A party. A party attended by the Jewish people against the edict of Mordechai, celebrating the end of Jewish history, L'chaim. That's the state, that the reason the Megillah opens with that story is to tell the reader, it's to tell you and I, all of us here, that that's where our people were. Now I thought to myself, really? How could you in 70 years go from being a religiously devout Jew, bringing sacrifices and offerings in the temple, 70 years, it's not even 70 years, it's at the tail end. 70 years later, you're assimilated into Persian society. Is that true? Can anyone think of anything else that happened like that? I always think of this. Because I've met people who in 70 years had a grandfather and a great-grandfather who were great Torah scholars in Eastern Europe, and their grandchildren and great-grandchildren were atheists in Russia. Because a communist society or other types of societies can suck the soul out of the Jewish people in 70 years. It happens. It happened in modern times. And of course, what we're really celebrating is what? The capacity to go back, to return. What happens? Look at number 3, you just read it. Kanos et kol yodim, she says, go assemble all the Jews and get everybody to fast and to do something religious and get them to do it together. And let me go before the king with that spiritual merit. And of course, that moment was when the Talmud teaches, v'nafochu, everything was switched up. Everything is upside down, everything looks random, looks happenstance. There's one other little story in the stories. Anybody know the little side story? says why this would make such a good movie. I don't know why. Nobody's made a movie out of this. There was like an Esther movie. It was bad. It wasn't well done. But this is such a good... I mean, somebody should buy the rights for this thing and to the Bible.
You have to buy the rights.
No, I think you just make a movie. Point, right? There's a little side story. You made a little side story. Ahasuerus can't sleep.
More to defend the generals?
Right, so Ahasuerus can't sleep. He calls in as one of his advisors. What do you do when the king can't sleep? Drinks a little milk. No, he calls in his advisors to open up the Sefer Zichronot. They open up to the page of the Book of Chronicles, and there is a description that Mordechai the Jew saved the king from an assassination plot. It's a little side story. There were two people trying to kill the king, as many people tried to do. And he understood all these languages because he was a member of the Sanhedrin. He had to understand 70 languages. He revealed this assassination attempt to Esther, who let the authorities know. They had the matter looked into and they killed the two guys. Ahasuerus turns to his advisors and he says, was this guy Mordechai, the Jew? Was he ever rewarded? And he's like, no. Now you have to understand, this is happening after the edict has already been promulgated, that on the 14th of Adar, all the Jews would be killed. This is the bizarre nature of the story.
He's projecting the guy who's going to kill it.
Right, so he calls Haman in.
Yeah.
He calls Haman in. Haman, he says, tell me, if there's someone that the king wishes to show great honor to, what would you suggest we do to someone who the king wishes to reward? What does Haman say?
Your robes, your stuff, you know, bring around the kingdom and your horses.
Put him on the royal horse, the white horse, the robe, and get somebody who's really important to walk before him, declaring that this is the way the king rewards those who are loyal to the king. So Ahasuerus, like, great idea. Go find Mordechai the Jew and do that, and you be the guy who walked. Now this is what's happening. By the way, the Megillah says that later on he came home that night and he told his wife, Zeresh. Sometimes she gets booed a lot also when we read the Megillah. He tells his wife Zeresh, and you know what she says? Very unsupportive wife.
Oh, it's your fault.
She said, if Mordechai is from the seed of the Jews, you have only begun to fall. This is what his wife tells her. Okay? She understood. And what ended up happening, of course, is that... Now, how does Queen Esther get Ahasuerus to rescind the edict and to turn on Haman? What does he? What does she do?
He doesn't rescind the edict, does he?
She reveals herself as a...
She reveals herself how? How does she reveal herself? Is that enough just to say, I'm Jewish, don't kill my people, please?
Well, no, she throws a feast and invites the king and Haman.
Good.
Mike Ahasuerus.
Yeah.
Ahasuerus. I struggle with that one.
It's okay.
Ahasuerus goes into another room for some reason and comes back and like Haman's on top of her or whatever.
So at the first party, Ahasuerus turns to Esther and says, okay, what can I do for you? You called me to this party. Ad chatzia malchut v'te'ash. I'll give you half my kingdom, whatever you want. And what does she do?
She asks
him to come to a second party. And at the second party, she of course invites Haman as well. And she stages things. What is she trying to get Ahasuerus to see here?
Haman's a terrible, terrible, terrible person.
She's trying to see not just that he's a bad guy. She wants Ahasuerus to start believing. Remember, who does she know and who do we know Ahasuerus to be from the beginning opening story? The parties, the killing Vashti. He is insecure. And a guy like Haman, she sizes him up pretty well too. Who's Haman? This big egomaniac who everyone has to bow before. The guy with the ego and the guy with the two alpha males. One with an ego and one with insecurities. She plays one off brilliantly.
Getting Ahasuerus to think that Haman was not only after the throne, but also after who?
Her.
Thank you. She puts him in a little uncompromising position where it looks as though he's trying to hit on her. And all of a sudden Ahasuerus becomes livid. Finds out, listen to this, how it comes together. Finds out. Somebody comes to Ahasuerus and says, he has prepared gallows for Mordechai. Now who's Mordechai to Ahasuerus?
The guy that saved his life.
The guy who saved Ahasuerus' life. And Haman's trying to kill him? Haman's trying to kill the guy who saved my life? Who foiled the assassination attempt against the king? This is all adding up. Now, what is the hope? There's so many themes in the story, guys. I just want to leave you with one or two. Number one, life seems random. Life seems a little story here, a little story there, and a little, he couldn't fall asleep, and then this, and then the gallows and all that. And what is really happening? What's happening is that you see there's no such thing as a poor. There's no such thing as a lottery in life. Things look random. Things look happenstance and arbitrary. But everything has a right. We may not all see the whole picture. And sometimes life looks like there's no God, because he's hidden. And our job is to reveal God behind his hiddenness. That's the idea of wearing a costume. That's the idea of Esther's name being hidden. That's the idea of there's the king. But where is the king? Oh, Achashverosh. We think the only people pulling the strings in our life are the kings, the politicians, your teachers, your boss. No, there's a king. There is the king of kings who is orchestrating things. And it's complicated because we believe in free will. We believe that the decisions we make in life matter. It's not like God is just doing his own thing. Whatever you do doesn't matter anyway. It's complicated. I'm studying that tonight afterwards. How do we reconcile free will with Hashgacha, God's providential orchestration of the world? The Purim story is a fascinating demonstration of Jewish belief in what? That just because you don't see something doesn't mean there isn't a force at work. And another very important lesson, anti-Semitism comes in all forms. Because, and this is very relevant for what's happening today, what we unfortunately saw within, I think, even in the political world, in Congress. Because sometimes we get used to anti-Semitism coming in a certain form. In America, we're used to anti-Semitism being kind of like a right-wing, neo-Nazi...
Country club anti-Semitism.
Country club, almost like white supremacist kind of thing. We're seeing, in my opinion, a new form of anti-Semitism, which is coming much more from the left today. And I'm not trying to, God forbid, paint the entire left as anti-Semitic. It's not true. But it's associated with an extreme left today in our society. And it's an anti-Israel, and it's using the guise of legitimate criticism of the state of Israel as an expression to legitimate age-old anti-Semitism. What you learn from the Megillah is don't ever get too used to one form of anti-Semitism. Okay, because what did Haman say to convince Achashverosh? He said they're not good citizens. They're detached. They follow their own rules. Anybody know what Hitler said?
He said they're everywhere and nowhere.
The just the opposite, though, Hitler. Hitler said they're marrying our sons, they're marrying our daughters, they're taking over the banks, they're manipulating, they're getting too close to us. Haman says they're too far. This is the problem when you start getting into the warped brain of a bigot. You start asking yourself, oh, why does he hate me? Oh, if he hates me for that reason, let me become the opposite. And by the way, Jews have done this in Jewish history. They hate us because of this, let's become that. They hate us because of this, let's become that. Turn yourself into a pretzel and try to become the opposite of why you think your enemies hate you. You know why they hate you? I don't know. Racism in general is an irrational expression of ignorance. It's not based on any real factors, ultimately. When you start getting into the real factors, you start trying to become something that you're really not. And it doesn't work anyway, because we have contradictory reasons why different people hated us at different times. Even within the same society, we're too loyal. We're not loyal enough. We have dual loyalty now. You know, it's not a rational thing, and I think we do ourselves a disservice when we become too attached. This is what anti-Semitism looks like, and if it's not expressing itself like that, like those types, and now it's coming from a different segment of society, then obviously it can't be anti-Semitism. We need to have a much more expansive and sophisticated view of what it means to be anti-Semite, because we see this through history.
Another good example is where Jews are painted as capitalists versus like socialists.
It's unbelievable. And by the way, in the same country.
Yeah.
Because there are people who paint Jews as being the total social leftists, mm-hmm. and the right-wing Republicans who have all the money and are controlling everything. It's amazing how we could be both.
Where are we?
There's only about 4 or 5 million Jews left in America, and we're both somehow.
Yeah.
It's an unbelievable thing. We're neither. Okay, now, that's not to say that there aren't really rich and powerful Jews.
It's not to say there aren't Jews like Bernie Sanders who might be more connected to socialism. Right? It's true. You can't be taken seriously if everything you say is completely absurd. You have to attach it to some truth. Mm-hmm. But is that a basis to hate? That's the question. Is it a basis to hate? And that's what we have to get up against, in my opinion. That's what we have to fight against, which is to call out anti-Semitism. Now, legitimate criticism of Israel's policies is cool. It's great. Jews criticize Israel like nobody else's business. But if you criticize Israel from the perspective of Israel has a legitimate right to exist, I just don't like the government's policies right here and right now. I think it should be this and as opposed to that. Reasonable minds will disagree. Always. There will always be disagreements. Two Jews, three opinions. And certainly from other countries and other peoples. But if you take a complicated situation like the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and you start painting it with black and white strokes and say because the Jewish people are doing A and not B, they must be oppressive, militant colonialists who took over after the Holocaust and garnered the world's sympathy and support in order to be able to kick out an indigenous people from their land. Okay, that's anti-Semitism. That's just a little more sophisticated form that a modern liberal can accept today. But it's no less dangerous than a right-winger who to everyone is an anti-Semite and nobody takes seriously anymore. The anti-Semitism like it forms has to like evolve and find its expression in a new way in order for it to be effective. And that's what's happened, I think, today. And we have to call it out. And that doesn't mean everybody on the left and anyone who's a Democrat or, you know, even a left Democrat or libertarian or Bernie Sanders hates Israel and hates Jews. That's nonsense. But there are some people in there that do. And they're beginning to co-opt and influence others. And that has to be called out.
Couldn't you say, like, even though there's a big population, I don't want to go too much into politics, this is a grenade.
It's okay. I really think this is an appropriate conversation.
But the evangelicals, or like certain Christian groups who give a lot of money to Israel, right. Some of their motivations could be construed as anti-Semitic because they want, their whole idea is that they right. want the Jews to go to Israel so that brings the redemption and it can cleanse our Jewish
right.
souls,
right.
which is inherently anti-Semitic.
So there's two responses to that. Some, you know, Rabbi Riskin once discussed this, one of my teachers, and he said, you know, okay, let's say it's true. Let's say that's why they're doing it. Let's say that's why they're supporting Israel.
Yeah. Not all evangelicals, but a certain group of them.
Yeah. Most of evangelicals, by the way, do not believe that.
Yeah, but there are
most of them believe because of the verses in Book of Genesis that whoever blesses the Jews will be blessed, whoever curses, and they believe in the holiness of the land of Israel. But there is a segment of Christian evangelicals that are doing this to convert the Jew. And, you know, Rabbi Riskin's attitude is like, listen, we don't have a lot of friends in the world. And right now, in the meantime, we could use their help and their support. And when the Messiah comes, we'll find out who was right. And we'll deal with it then. And, you know, right now, we can use their dollars and we can use their support. You know, that's kind of his attitude.
But is it not anti-Semitic?
I don't know. Do you consider that anti-Semitic? That's their belief. That's their faith. I don't think that makes them hate Jews. I don't see that. I don't know. Maybe you guys feel differently. I don't view that as a form of anti-Semitism. That's their belief system. I don't love it. You know, that's
because they think that.
Yeah, I understand.
Inferior.
No, it's not that they think. I think it's that they think that.
Where is something inherently wrong with us?
Well, there's inherently wrong with anyone who doesn't accept Jesus as their savior.
Right.
So anyone who doesn't accept Jesus as savior is obviously limited and needs to be changed. You know, or influenced. You have to respect that's their belief. As long as they don't have crusades and pogroms to impose it on other people, they can believe whatever they want. You know, I don't consider that, you know, whether you like it or not.
Yeah,
it's quite the line you draw. I mean, I got some room to play with.
Yeah. Yeah, please.
So earlier on in the year, I was listening to one of his Parsha classes, and we were discussing the money given to at the U.S. and Britain's pushing the money given to the State of Israel by Germany post-World War II, and whether or not it was blood money and all that kind of stuff. And one of the things I had said to him at that point was, the optics aren't great, because, right. and I think you and I had even discussed, like, the optics aren't great, because it's like, that whole thing that, like, Jews will take money, like, Jews love money, they'll take money for anything, they're even going to take it for them after they killed them, and now we're talking about evangelicals who may not have the most pure, and your response was, oh, we could use the help. So I was like, and I loop back to like, it's taking money that was given to us possibly for the wrong reason. Doesn't really look
yeah,
right.
But yeah, it, I didn't feel that about
it. It perpetuates the stereotype of Jews just being money hungry. Isn't that a problem?
I don't think that the stereotype of Jews being money hungry is going to, it started with Jews being money hungry. And I don't think it's going to be perpetuated by doing things that may look that way. If we keep behaving that way, we're basically saying that they're thinking this way because we are this way. They're thinking this way because it's just do you know why Jews became associated with money hungering?
The Catholic Church wouldn't allow them to handle the money, so Jews became the bankers.
We were forced into money lending. Because we were forced into money lending, and we became good at it, because we become good at most things we put our minds to. It doesn't make us bad people, it just makes us really smart.
Athletics would question that.
Yeah. You know, so I went, by the way, so Menachem Begin was the one, he literally took to the streets with protests. In the 1960s, the Germans offered reparations. Much of Israeli society was in favor of accepting those reparations. The question then became, what's that?
He was saying it was a close vote, though.
I wouldn't say overwhelming. It was a close vote, but I don't know. I love Menachem Begin is my favorite Israeli politician who ever lived. But 100%. But I disagree. I personally don't believe that accepting money from the Nazis was a way of showing the world we are, you know, if you pay money, we'll forgive you. I don't think people viewed it that way. I think people understood at that time Israel needed a lot of support. And do you know how much money the Nazis took from Jews? That's called, my grandmother used to get reparations. Okay, because my brother has all this, he's like the family archivist, but we had a very successful paint factory in Germany for many, many decades. And one day they came along and sent a letter to my grandfather, after him, named to Max Schoenwalter, and stamped the thing with a big swastika that said, Judenrein, and that was the end of the company. They did this to hundreds of thousands of very wealthy Jews. They took enormous amounts of money. They're not paying, they've never paid back. I'm just telling you. So you could look at it as blood money, or you could look at it as returning monies that were stolen from the Jewish people to their ancestors. And if they could help rebuild Jewish life in Israel, which was destroyed by the Holocaust, I personally don't have an issue with that. But I hear the way it looks, the optics, as you say, I get it. I'm just not into doing anything because it's going to feed into anti-Semitism. I'll tell you one other thing, which is important to know. Albert Einstein, in 1930, was approached first by Chaim Weizmann, who later became Israel's first president, to come to America and raise money for the Zionist cause. Okay? And the German Jewish establishment in Germany came to Einstein and tried to convince him not to go. Anybody know why? 3 years before Hitler came to power. Why didn't the Jewish establishment in Germany want Einstein to go with Chaim Weizmann to America to raise money for Zionism?
Well, they wanted to be viewed as good Germans.
Because they thought that what ended up happening in the end is that the German Jews would be looked upon as having a dual loyalty. And they wanted to be seen as good Germans first and foremost. And guess what happened in the United States during the Second World War? And I have a 50-page paper, if anybody wants to see this. I spent a year on this in graduate school. It's, I think, one of the reasons the American Jewish community did so well with Soviet Jewry is because of guilt. Because American Jews felt guilty that they didn't do more during the Second World War. Now, it would be unfair to compare the strength of American Jewry today with AIPAC and all the lobby groups and the money and the influence that we have with what we had here in the 1930s and 40s in America. We didn't have anywhere near the same power. But we had 7 members of Congress. We had Morgenthau, and we had others, members of the president's cabinet. And things were not done for our brethren across the ocean who were sent to the camps because of a concern by American Jews at the time that it would increase anti-Semitism here in the United States. When we start getting too concerned with what other people think about us, we don't do the right thing. And it's a reoccurring, you know, we want to be loved. The Jew loves to be loved. Pinny loves to say this, and I agree with him. We have a great, who doesn't want to be loved? Especially when you're settling your family in a certain country. But we have to understand that we're not going to be loved by everyone. There are going to be people that hate us. They're going to just going to be people. And we don't have to turn ourselves into pretzels to try to get them to like us. They should be ashamed of themselves for hating us, because there's no good reason. We should fight against anti-Semitism and not try to become the people we think we need to be for them to stop hating us. It doesn't work. And it's not the reason they hate us in the first place. And it's just one of the messages, I think, that comes out of here. You had a question? Yeah.
The idea of that we have to like continue to like stay different, and that's why other like there are some people who are anti-Semitic. Like if we can rationalize it, it's just because we need to continue to be different.
Well, the question is, why do we want to be the same? You know, especially in America.
I don't think it's because we need to be loved. Because like my grandma, who's like all of a survivor, she's like, we don't need to be like loved, we just want to be forgotten. And you know, like, really, like these people just wanted to have their own life and, you know, come back in the country and be comfortable.
Right.
And work.
Right.
But I don't think love is really the answer.
Right.
Like, maybe love from God, but
it's hard. I think we want to be accepted.
Mm-hmm.
We want to be accepted. And the beauty of this great country, which is different than most other diaspora communities, is that America stands for diversity. Meaning, you don't need to become like everyone else to be loved in America. The whole beauty of America, the whole reason the Founding Fathers established this country, was so that people could be themselves and be loved for who they are. And we still feel the need to be like everybody else. And that's what the opening, I think, the message, one of the messages of the story. That doesn't mean we should walk around thinking we're better than everyone else, that our religion is superior and everybody else is inferior and they don't... No, but we should be who we are and be proud of who we are. And if people don't accept it, that's their problem.
Does that sort of play into Alan Dershowitz is saying that anti-Semitism is like good for the...
Well, he said that to me probably about 4 or 5 years ago in front of about 500 people. He spoke at my mother's Yahrzeit lecture. And he said, because I quoted something from his book.
Yeah.
He wrote a great book called The Vanishing American Jew.
Yeah.
And he said to me, he says, you rabbis are going to have to figure out how to make Judaism appeal to people. Because one day there won't be any more anti-Semitism. What's going to keep the Jews Jewish? Now that's a sad commentary, that we need anti-Semitism, you know, that we need to be, our backs need to be pushed up against the wall to be proud of our Judaism. Sometimes when someone says, you can't do this, that's the rebellious part of you wants to fight back. No, the reason we want to be Jewish is because the Torah is awesome. And being a devout Jew is a great way to live. And it's also an ethical system for the world that we want to share with our brothers and sisters, with everybody.
What about loyalty to tradition?
Also
be something?
Of course.
I feel like that's
of
that,
course.
That appeals to a lot of people as well.
The loyalty? You feel that way?
To tradition.
You have to have some background for that, though, because I find that people who have that kind of loyalty grew up with something.
Yeah.
A lot of young people today are not growing up with that. And what appeals to that young Jew? You know, so what I've tried to do here is to show how Judaism has all these great... That's why I wrote this book, was to show like 10 different ways that Judaism makes you happier, more fulfilled.
Mm-hmm.
Or... you know, to show relevance and inspiration, or the authenticity and the veracity of Judaism, like it's true, it's real. But I'm a big loyalist, like you are. That appeals to me because I grew up that way. But I've met a lot of people who've come through our doors that just don't have that feeling. They don't have that sentiment
because
to their lineage. Because they didn't really grow up feeling that. Their parents or grandparents, they just didn't feel that so much. I don't know. I think people are different. Some people feel that loyalty and they want to just be Jewish because their parents were, their grandparents, they want to pass it on. And other people are like, I don't know, what's so special about being Jewish? What's so worthwhile transmitting it?
Yeah, but there had to have been something even for the people that grew up less religious, or else how do they end up in your doors? Because you didn't. Because I.
To the point. Everybody.
You're not the guy who was on the corner usually during the high holidays asking me, "Are you Jewish? Would you like to come into this random truck and shake a little?"
No, I know.
I had him in college.
Yeah, but I don't know. Maybe that's why somebody complained that all of our emails keep saying "open bar." Everything says "open bar." One of my donors called me this week and he's like, "Do you guys do anything else there other than drink?" Like, he's never been here. He just gets the email.
It's just a bonus.
So yeah, it's a bonus, but maybe that's we always think. Right, so I'm thinking, they come for the booze, and then once they get here, they realize there's something deeper, and maybe they'll come back. I don't know, how many people come to the prayer service or standing in the back of the room and going, checking out the merchandise, like, who's here? Or the Kiddush afterwards. I don't know, like, you had a question?
I know he was raising his hand.
All right, we're going to finish up in a second, yeah.
The person that spoke at the yard site, I think
it's...
Alan Dershowitz. It sounded like... to me, that he's just making an argument from very narrow viewpoints, like talking about an economic issue with only one factor or variable, or making a debate about immigration that, you know, immigrants from Mexico, there's a couple instances of people killing people.
Right.
That
so
are
they
there.
Right.
So applying
that's the whole right. Right.
So many other.
Yeah, life is complicated. Yes. Usually when anyone gives one reason for something this complicated. Yeah.
But I think the point he's getting to, which is real, is like, my grandfather grew up and like got beat up walking through the Italian section of like New Haven because like he was a Jewish and they killed, you know, the Jews killed Jesus. Like, that's going to tell you you're Jewish,
was he
right?
Religious or?
No, not at all.
Yeah,
no.
Was this New Haven?
Yeah, this is New Haven. But so like, that's going to tell you you're Jewish, whereas like, now that like, you know, his grandson could be marrying that guy's granddaughter, right? There's not the difference there, right? It's different. What's telling you?
Be a good way to smile.
Huh? Like, what's telling that guy that he's Jewish, right? Because it's not, you know, being beat up.
I guess my point is, anti-Semitism is not the rallying cry for all Jewish people.
No, but
of course.
No, but it's
that helps maybe in small.
I mean, it's sad. To me, it's a sad commentary because I think Judaism is awesome. And that's not the reason we should follow it, because someone's kicking us in the butt.
What sparked my sister is about Jew, and she actually, I think, the one thing that pushed her into...
was anti-Semitism.
Anti-Semitic experience when she was living in France. I think that was like the beginning, and she came back here and started. So, that's an example.
There's no question that it has a...
I think it's what about the need for
meaning and purpose, yeah.
I mean, that could also... I think that draws a lot of people, but that appeals to a certain type of person.
We get a lot of that at MJE. I think a lot of people who come here are looking for more meaning and purpose in life, and they're finding it in Judaism, 100%. You know, but also other people don't like to be told what not to do or who not to be. So like, even if they don't love Judaism, somebody comes along and says, "Hey, Jew boy," and all of a sudden they're defending Judaism. That happens. What was that?
Hey, Jew boy. That's what Shuki always says. Hey, Jew boy.
I grew up in Forest Hills, Queens, not so long ago. And, I grew up across the street from Forest Hills High School. And every day, almost every day, we were playing. We would have like our recess in high school. Like, I don't know, we'd play football from like always like 2:15 to like 2:45. That was our break between the Hebrew studies and the English studies. That's when Forest Hills High was getting out. And oh, there was always people walking by. "Oh, look at the Jews playing football. You guys, I thought you guys were just smart. You know, I thought you guys had a lot of money." I'm serious. This is
that's not as bad as it could be. Really?
Yeah, I thought it was relatively speaking.
I'll tell you one story. I'm going to turn this off.